Accession number 18439, Real 1.
Albert Tyus, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
Born in Dewsbury, 10th of March, 1929.
So, did you grow up and have your schooling in Dewsbury?
Yes, I did. Yes.
And you were a schoolboy in the Second World War in Dewsbury?
That's right.
What was it like during those years for you?
Well, we were well tied up with the war. I had two brothers and a sister which served in the RAF. And my father had been a survivor on the Battle of the Somme in the First World War. So we were all rather military-minded, and it was accepted that we would all be in the forces in some state or other. All the six children served in the forces. I was only 40. I was only 11 years old when the war started, and in 1943 I left school in March 43 to start work, and I was involved in all sorts of things in the Dewsbury area. We didn't have much aerial bombardment in Dewsbury, just a couple of air raids, because we're right in the middle of Yorkshire. We didn't get the bombing that Hull got and the other major cities such as Sheffield and the likes of. But everybody had to partake in some useful occupation or other during the war. Some of the young men that rode their bikes as messengers during air raids. And everybody had to partake in some form of activity.
What did you participate in yourself?
Well, for myself, I was not participating in that respect, in as much that we had to attend night school as apprentices. But we were ordered to register at the age of 16, and we knew that eventually we would be in the army.
What was your apprenticeship?
I was apprentice plumber.
Where did the bombs fall in Dewsbury?
Well, in Dewsbury, the bombs fell at Wakefield Road outside a plumber shop that I eventually went to work for. And another major explosive exploded on the pit property, and then another stick was dropped in Savile Town. I think all in all there were about six people killed, which was the major attack.
Which years did the bombs fall?
1940. I was still at school attendance. I remember coming home on the night the air raid started, and it was about 9 o'clock. We were coming out of the orchestra class at school, and the ACAT guns, which were stationed all around Dewsbury, because Dewsbury itself is in a basin surrounded by commanding cliffs, and the aircraft guns, anti-aircraft guns in the RASC and RA, were mounted on the hilltops, and they all let go together. But they were drone of aircraft, and I can remember these particular aircraft droning as the German aircraft did. Still type of woof woof effort. A right drone, up and down drone. And all the anti-aircraft guns in the surrounded area let go at one go. And it was quite startling. We realised then we were in a major war, because up to that point there'd been nothing but involving Dewsbury except the enlistment of men. And the town, of course, was flooded by the influx of army. There were army detachments stationed in the local church schoolroom, and places were confiscated to accommodate an influx of army men. We had a major battery of Royal Signals and RAC in our area. And there were also always a flood of army wagons knocking about, and much activity.
What was your address in Dewsbury during the war?
Number 54, Thornton Street, Butheroyd Lane, Dewsbury.
Did the bombs fall anywhere near that address?
Well, we had quite a few incendiary bombs. The place was, of course, was showered with incendiaries, but not apart from two sticks of HE. We had no other major attacks, except later on in 1940, back end of 1944, we had four or five Dougal bugs, which were the VE ones, came so far inland, and they reached this area. But they didn't do any damage. They dropped in agricultural areas. So there were no loss of life.
Did you suffer from shortages or rationing?
Well, rationing applied to people like us living in the streets because there was nowhere for us to keep livestock, in as much that this area here, now 5 miles out of Dewsbury, was lots and lots of rural areas, and they were well able to keep pigs and keep hens and things like that to sustain themselves, whereas in the streets, the people that lived in the streets had nothing, and they had the bare minimum of ration, which was not a lot. Towns are making a family from 1 egg per person, and the likes of. No, rationing did hit the people in the streets very, very more so than what it hit people in rural areas.
Were there any celebrations in Dewsbury at the end of the war?
Oh yes, major celebrations there were in all areas, at VE Day and VJ Day. And also during the war, we always had major weeks which we at the school had to take part in. The first one was the Spitfire Week, which we Dewsbury people collected enough to buy a Spitfire for £5,000. And then the next week, which was on the year after, was War Weapons Week, and the target for the people in Dewsbury was £750,000. They achieved it quite easily, and in fact they surpassed it and attained the figure of 1,250,000, which was phenomenal for a small working class area like Dewsbury was. And on the national scale, Dewsbury, Heckmondwike and Batley were the highest per head of population for the money they collected in the War Weapons Week. They were quite astounding at that time, because £1 million, of course, was an unthinkable figure. And the week after War Weapons Week, we had Wings for Victory Week, we had Warship Week when we bought a destroyer warship, and then we had the Tanks for Attack Week. And they all took place 6 to 9 months after each other, and it was a method the government employed of getting people to contribute money to help the war effort.
Now, coming on to how you joined the army yourself, can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, I was. Everybody had to register. It was given out on the radio that people born by such and such an age group had to register at the local employment exchange, and that would apply to the people at 16 years old, because the government didn't know who they had. And by doing that, you also had to put down the fact that you were an apprentice tradesman, because apprentice tradesmen were not taken into the forces until they were 21 years old, because an apprenticeship lasted 7 years, from 14 to 21. I refused to do that because I was eager to get into the forces. Because in 1947-48, when I was 18 years old, nobody had any means of getting out of the area you lived in. We didn't travel. We didn't go on holidays, and to get into the army was something that one looked forward to, because at the end of the war, when the men came home and were working with you as plumbers, they used to tell such romantic tales as about Egypt and India, Burma, fighting these wars, and it all seemed so romantic that I thought, I'm getting into this army. So I refused to fill in the form which said I was an apprentice plumber. So I got my first calling up papers on the 10th of March 1947, and I was called up into the Green Howards and had to report to Richmond. I went to work that Saturday morning, because all the calling up papers always came on a Friday. I went to work Saturday morning and I was so joyful about it. I told the gaffer, I said, I'm going into the army. He said, no, you're bloody not, and he took the papers from me, and he went back and sent the papers in, and I was stopped from going into the army and given a deferment for 12 months. Along with that deferment came a choice of being able to go down the pit to avoid army service. And I got one of those every birthday for 3 years after that. So in 1950, when I was 21, with me calling up papers, my calling up papers came with my birthday cards for my 21st birthday, and I was in the army to report to Strensel Barracks on the on the 21st of 28th of March 1950, and I was in then, and I was one of the oldest on the intake, because everybody else on the intake were 18 years old, but just a few of us who had been deferred were 21 years of age, and 3 years were a long time to be older than your compatriots. And that made us eligible by that time. Little did we know that the Korean War was going to start in June 1950, and the army would be only looking forward to looking to take the older men, which they did. But of course, when the First World War started, the Korean War started in June 24th, 1950, the idea was not to take conscription men, conscripts, but the government in turn changed its mind 3 months after, stuck on an extra 6 months from 18 months to 24 months, and they took us to Korea.
And can you tell me about how you got there, please?
Yeah, we went there. We left on the 4th of November 1950, and we boarded a troop ship called the Charlton Star, and it took 6 weeks. But the ship itself had a big problem, and we were taken off the ship in Singapore on the 4th of December 1950 and sent up to join the Green Howards. It were a mistake in the administration, because we were down as first line reinforcements to the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, which was the battalion I had been with in England prior to them being directed to go and join the 29th Brigade and go to Korea. We were sent back to depot from the battalion because they weren't going to take national servicemen. But then, during this period of time when the government changed its mind, stuck us another 6 months on and then threw us out to Korea. So then, when they realised they'd made the mistake by dropping us in December 1950 in Malaya, in Singapore, while that period in Singapore, the Jungle Girl riot started. And there was a great upheaval in Singapore. 34 people were killed in the first night of the rioting, and the battalion had to patrol the streets for 3 weeks to quell the uprising.
Did that involve you?
Yes, we patrolled the streets with arms and everything to quell the rising.
What were these riots about?
It was called the Jungle Girl riots, and it were a young lady involved by the name of Mariah Hertog, and she was a young lady who'd been brought up by, she had Dutch parents, but in the escape from Singapore in 1941, she was given over to an Asian family, a Malaysian family rather, and they brought her up. Then in 1950, the Hertogs came back from Holland and claimed their daughter, but she'd been brought up a Malay and in the Muslim faith, and the Muslims, of course, the Muslims, or whatever they were, they rioted in great numbers, and there was great chaos. And it took 3 weeks to quell the riots.
So you were patrolling the streets of Singapore?
Yes, certainly was, yes.
Can you describe in detail what happened?
Well, we didn't have much to do. We didn't have any firing to do, because we weren't allowed to fire unless we read the Riot Act. But we were on street patrols the whole time. When they saw our military presence, of course, they were not burning out cars and committing mayhem like all the Orientals seemed to be gifted to do. For one short period, 1 week, we were given over to the judge who'd made the decision to send Miss Hertog back to her family. And he had a big house on Singapore Island, and we were stationed in his house doing patrols of his garden to protect his welfare. That was quite something.
So did you have any frightening incidents during those riots?
Well, not particularly. We were all young. We thought it was real. We thought it was part of being in the army. We didn't actually see anyone get killed. But at that time, that was the first time we lost one of our men, inasmuch as he were a man who was gifted to epileptic fits. And when we rose one morning at Rivali, about the second week in December, he was found dead at the foot of his bed. And what was rather a shock was the speed with which we were suddenly, he was declared dead at 6 o'clock in the morning and buried at 12. And that rather shook us. in that period of time, we'd have breakfast changed, everybody into bulldog kit, and we had to learn the slow march to commit his body to the ground. And it seemed so quick, in a matter of 6 hours, he was dead, declared dead, and in the ground. With the heat of Singapore, that is the procedure. And that rather shook us.
Which unit were you patrolling with when you were patrolling the streets?
We were patrolling the streets with the Green Howard Regiment.
The 1st Battalion?
1st Battalion Green Howards.
And this was December 50?
December 50. And then Christmas Day, notification came, we were to leave immediately on the 1st of January, near enough that time, and take a civilian boat straight up to Japan to join the battalion in Korea. We were put on a civilian boat called the SS Sangola and taken up to Hong Kong, stayed a night in Hong Kong, and then on to Kure in Japan.
What was that voyage like?
Oh, that was an horrendous voyage. But we were just 40 men, and we were allowed to travel first, well, civilian first class, but it was a tramp steamer. They looked after us well. We'd nothing to do but the, oh, it was a horrible tramp ship. It had no luxury apart from these 10 cabins which they put the men in. And that was the only bit of luxury there was on it.
And what was your first impression of Japan?
Oh, Japan was a beautiful place, an absolute beautiful place. We were kept at Japan in a place called Kure, and JRBD was its initials. It was Joint Brigade Holding Group. And we were there to train for 3 weeks before going across to Korea. They gave us some advanced training because it was thought that we hadn't had enough experience for frontline conditions. We had an extreme 3 weeks battle treatment. And then we flew across to Korea and flew to Suwon about the first week in February 1951.
Who's we?
Well, I'm saying that the section that we were, the platoon of men that I was with, we were sent to the 29th Brigade to make up the numbers because they'd had some losses in January, late January, and we went up to make the number. I was not fortunate enough to go back to my battalion, but I was seconded to the Royal Ulster Rifles, who was one of the three battalions, British battalions, in the 29th Brigade. The three battalions being, of course, the 1st Gloucesters, the 1st RNFs, and the 1st RURs.
Did you find the Ulsters much different from the Green Howards?
Yes, much different, because the Ulsters were a light infantry regiment, and we were heavy infantry in Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and there was a lot of difference in the drill formations. Not that we had much to do, but there was a vast difference to a light infantry from heavy infantry. But nevertheless, we had to do what we were told.
Did you get a welcome from them?
Well, we joined the battalion in the front line, and there was no such thing as a welcome. We were just taken out and that in the night and put in a section of men, and they all seemed to talk a lot differently coming from Northern Ireland, from the Yorkshire twang and Geordie twang that I'd been used to with the Northumberland Fusiliers.
What was it like in the front line in the place where you were?
Well, I joined them on the big push up to the Anne River. We were in the front line first time for 10 days, I think about 10 days. And there wasn't much contact with the Chinese, but you were sleeping in slit trenches and you were sleeping in rough conditions and it were extremely, extremely cold. It was well below freezing. And it was quite, I thought it was quite horrendous. But there were all plenty to watch bombardments, sabre jets dropping the palm, there were all plenty of activity and loads of artillery barrages to watch. So you felt part of something, although there was nobody in actual fact. There were nobody in actual fact getting blown away and killed. They were not attacking us, we were attacking them, in as much we were driving them back to the line of the Han River, which became known as the Kansas Line.
And which company and platoon and section were you put in?
I was put in 4 Platoon B Company. What section number? I can't remember the section number. But 4 Platoon B Company, 1st IURs.
Can you describe in detail what happened to you up to the engine, please?
Well, we did various jobs. We was taken out of the line after 10 days and put in a rest period into a rest area about 5 mile or 10 mile behind the line at a place called Wee John Boo. We were back cleaning kit and oiling weapons and the likes of. And then we were taken away then to do escort to an American unit, which was a unit of big self-propelled guns, and we were infantry support for this unit. And we stayed with those for a week. Every time we had to sleep at the side of the guns and guard these guns. It were a big self-propelled gun. Every time it whacked a salvo over, the ground used to lift. If you were to sleep in your sleeping bag at the side of the gun, you'd lift off the floor. Oh, an horrendous place. But nevertheless, it were all what one would expect in a frontline situation. We went into the line at 1st of April 1950. We moved onto the Imjin River then. And there was very little contact with the enemy for 3 weeks. On the April 10th, we took a big commanding hill the other side of the Imjin River, and we stayed on that hill for until the 20th of April. The company itself had done big sweeps out over into no man's land, north of the Imjin River, even though we ourselves were north of the river, and did its sorties and that deep penetrating patrol for up to 20 miles into enemy territory and never contacted, apart from a bit of sniping from the Chinese troops. On the 20th of April, we were pulled back with B Company from this commanding hill over the river, and the hill was taken over by the 1st Battalion Belgium Regiment. What number they were exactly, I don't know, but we just referred to them 1st Belgians. And the Belgians took over our positions. We, as B Company, were brought back 2 miles behind the line into a saddle position on the MSR.
MSR?
The main supply group. Road, and that night when we came back, we were on these positions, and that's the night the main attack came in from the Chinese, which is referred to as the Imjin River Battle. They attacked the whole 4 battalions of the brigade with 30,000 men.
What was your first inkling of what was happening?
Well, we were in a position Saturday night. We were the reserve battalion behind the other three, and they allowed us to watch a film on the Saturday night. It was called D for Two, and it starred Doris Day and Gordon McRae. Then all of a sudden, the sky seemed to light up and tracers were flying everywhere. Good God, what's happening? Oh, they said there's a major attack coming in from the Chinese. The film will have to be stopped. Everybody back to their positions. And that was the start of the battle, and our first inclination of the battle starting 2 mile farther up the road on the Imjin River. The Gloucesters were attacked in great numbers, also the Northumberland Fusiliers, and the Belgian battalion was completely surrounded.
Can you take me through step by step what happened to you up to your capture, please?
Well, on the Sunday it was quite, we, in this reserve position, we were not under any attack whatsoever. The battalion had a battle patrol, which was the first of the Royal Ulster Rifles to get contact with the enemy. They were under the command of Major Ricord, and he took his battle patrol across the river to open up the road to allow the Belgians to pull out. But the battle patrol was practically decimated by the force of the Chinese attack. On the Monday, we went. We were notified that the Gloucesters were completely surrounded, and we had to go and open up the road to the Gloucesters. We went in Oxford Carriers, down the road to the Gloucesters, which was about 5 miles down the road to the Gloucester. We went the roundabout way, and we opened up the road. Even though we could see Chinese on the mountain tops, we were not fired on in any way, and we went to the Gloucester positions, reported to the Gloucesters, and we were ordered back to our positions. We went back straight away down the same road, and then we were notified when we got to the end that the road had closed again. There was no other way to contact the Gloucesters. On the Tuesday morning, we had skirmish contact with the Chinese, who were on a commanding hill to the left of our positions. The hill was famously known as Kamak San. On the Monday, we reported that we could see Chinese at top of Kamak San, which was a commanding hill looking down onto our positions. And the officer in charge reported the Chinese being seen at top of Kamak San, and they said, oh no, officials said, it can't be so, they must be Koreans, so forget all about it. Late Tuesday night, the Chinese put in a full-scale attack onto our mountain top, and we were completely blown to bits. Bombarded us with many, many mortars, and all night we had flares over our positions dropped by spotter aircraft. Flares were illuminated the whole job, and the whole platoon was in. We fired all night, we threw hand grenades all night, had a right major attack on our positions. When the major attack started, first thing we knew, it was coming in, because the Chinese, before the attack, they always bang cymbals, blow bugles, shout charge. Your bloody ass stood up, and that were it. All hell let loose, and everybody were firing willy-nilly at characters fleeing about in the darkness, which were Chinese attacking us and throwing hand grenades. By the time early morning came, we'd had quite a few mortar bombs on, and people started moving off the hilltop under command. We moved off the hilltop, and my best friend was killed on that hilltop. He was fetched out of his position by Rifleman Brennan, and he was given to me, and he said, carry him down the hill, and the stretcher bearers on the way up. I carried him 100 yards, down the hill, because the hills were enormous. And I just put him down, and he died in my arms. Then the stretcher bearers came up and took him away.
Who was this friend?
Keith Wintersgill. He was gone out with us all the time. We'd be very close. He came from Eby. And he was the first good friend that I lost. And that was my first initiation at losing a close friend.
How much firing?